So, welcome to the Reverie Podcast. I have with me Manny Skratus of Skratus Family Cymbal Company. Is that the way to say it?
That's the one. Yeah, you can say, some people say Skratus, some people say Skratus. It doesn't matter.
Cool. Love it. So thank you so much for coming on the podcast. We have known of each other, and this is our first in-person, well, not really in-person, through virtual means, our first conversation. Yeah. So I'm
this is basically what in-person is nowadays. So this counts. This
Welcome
counts.
To 2024. Yeah. So we usually do a little intro of just tell us who you are. And we'll get into all the cymbal making stuff, maybe how you got started, but just tell us who you are, what you do, and we'll just go from there.
Cool. Yeah. Well, I'm right now, my business is established in New Braunfels, Texas, which is where my wife was born, which is kind of long story short, how we ended up down here. But I'm born and raised Canadian, as some people know, just outside Toronto. I was born in a place called Markham, which is a great town. And that's kind of where I started. But I started pretty late. Like I didn't have a drum kit. I didn't start drumming until I was like 21 or 22 or something like that. So it's been a few years at this point, but usually, you know, I was a little bit of a late bloomer on that. I played other instruments, but then when I found the drums, I dove head first in. And I was working at the Canadian Music Store along in McQuaid, which is a great place to work. You know, if any musicians out there in Canada are looking for somewhere to work, definitely hit them up. But the drum manager at the store that I was working at, his name is Craig Toutant. He was the guy who we would just sit there and talk about stuff. And I was really interested in learning everything about a whole bunch of different instruments, but he kind of took me under his wing and made sure that I, you know, not just knew how to sell the stuff, but actually knew what I was talking about in terms of having a love and a passion for the instrument. And then I started just kind of looking into how cymbals were made, because I really liked how they sounded. And I was just getting into jazz and learning about the rad cymbal pattern. And it all kind of started from the point where I was able to, like, you know, the Pearl export kits and stuff like that, mm-hmm. where they just have those stamped brass little cymbals that come with it. And you know, everybody kind of replaces those immediately. So we would do drum kit rentals, and we obviously couldn't rent those cymbals out because they would break immediately when people did them. So we had a big stack of them in the back, just these little stamped brass things, and they were getting all grungy, and some of them were years and years old. So I talked to my manager. I was like, hey, what are we're cleaning house, taking inventory and stuff. What are we doing with these? They don't have a barcodes or anything. They're just sitting there. Is it cool if I take them? And he was like, yeah, please get them out of here.
Yeah.
And then from that point, it was just building up the courage to swing a hammer at one of them for the first time. And that's kind of where it started. From that point, you know, I feel like the story is similar for most of us. You catch the bug and you start learning a whole bunch more, and you know, watch the Bosphorus Masters video like everybody does. And from that point, we talked earlier about, you know, getting into some scrappy repairs. Which makes me cringe now thinking about it. I had a buddy who brought in some K high definition hi-hats, which are, you know, those have a fan base, and people who love them, and they you can't get them anymore. So people are really into trying to preserve them as long as they can. So a buddy of mine came by and he was like, hey, I heard you're doing this. Can you repair these for me? They just had a little crack on the edge. And I was telling you this before, I had no idea what I was doing. So I just clamped them down on a workbench, and I took my dad's old jigsaw and just kind of went to work on it. And I can't even think about it now. It just makes it hurts me. But that's the kind of stuff where you look back and then you see yourself now and realize kind of how far you've come. But the real thing that kind of pushed everything forward into what this was now was when COVID hit, obviously. We were at Long & McQuaid. We managed to kind of finagle ourselves into being an essential business. So we were still open for curbside pickup for the entire time. We never closed our doors once, but people couldn't come inside. So that means we were just preparing orders for people, taking them out the door and coming back inside. So I was literally standing in the drum section with the wall of cymbals, just moving from one to another all day. If there wasn't an order being filled, that's what I was doing. And that's kind of, that's what I can thank for, you know, starting to learn how to train my ears and think about looking at profiles and think, okay, so what is it about this one that makes it sound this way? And then when we moved here to Texas and I got my, work permit and everything like that, that was the first thing that I did. It was a little bit scary, of course, starting a new business on your own, but we launched in February and that's kind of brought us to where we are now.
Yeah. Love it. Yeah. You touched on kind of the DIY nature of doing this indie cymbalsmith thing. We have, I mean, there's guys like our mutual friend, Dave Collingwood, who has a Patreon and does some training, but, in the end, there really is no place to go to get officially trained unless you were somehow able to go to Turkey and convince those guys to like train you there. Yeah. But even then you're probably doing like a 3 to 5 day thing and then you're out. And this is the thing that takes, you know, it takes years. It takes a lot of time and then a lot of near disasters. And, you know, you're doing it the best way you know how. And then you realize, whoa, that was not the right way to do it. And then you change, you kind of slowly evolve. And as it's, I mean, you said that about COVID. I think that was when I dove deeper into cymbals. Like I'd been doing it since late 2017 and building drums since 2015. And then kind of running, manufacturing on all different sides of the drum thing. And then 2020, like I've talked to other friends about this. Like it was really, there was a lot negative about 2020, obviously. But there has been a lot of, it just forced people to kind of, obviously you're alone. And so you're like, what do I do with my time? And I think for a lot of people, it has been sort of like a training ground or like a hotbed for them to there was focused energy surrounding whatever it is that they wanted to do. Cause you had all this extra time.
Sure.
And so I'm like incredibly, I mean, beyond just like the, obviously the sickness and death, which is horrible, but the concentrated time that we all had to dive into our craft was really a gift and kind of a blessing. And I think it, for me at least, it definitely propelled me farther than I would have been without that time. Cause all I did
Absolutely.
Was make sense. I was just, all I was doing was in my garage hammering cymbals. Really, I mean, I talked to everyone about this on the podcast. I talked to them about what do you think of the I guess current boom of indie cymbal smiths, and there seem to be more popping up. It's still very niche, but there seems to be more of these guys popping up, and then, you know, in 5 years we might have double or even triple what we have now. And kind of, my big question has been, where does this lead? Because, you know, there is a very severe limitation on what we do. It's all our bodies. It's, as long as our bodies can handle swinging a hammer, we can keep producing. And there seems to be a huge gap between us and, you know, companies that employ 50 to hundreds of people even.
Yeah.
And tons of people making the cymbals. There's a big gap there, but we are growing as a small niche industries. Where do you see things going? Like, what do you think about the cymbal market today, where it is, where it's going, just whatever you want to go with on that?
Yeah, man, I think it's the biggest thing about it is that we as independents are, it's the same as basically any other industry. Like we as independents are offering something that the big companies just can't. It's due to their size and the time and budget restraints and the fact that they haven't, you know, investors in most cases, and they have to absolutely hit a bottom line or else bad things could happen with their company. But we're in a place where we're a little bit more free to talk straight up with the customer and let them know exactly what we can do and try to fulfill exactly what they want. Cause you know, you talk to some of the big companies, we can use, you know, Zildjian as an example, that you try to get something custom from them And certain times, unless you're one of their artists, it can be like pulling teeth. They're like, okay, we have this line, this line, this line, and this line. And they're like, yeah, I kind of want, you know, something a little bit different than that. If it, even if it just, can we get this line, but something that's as light as possible? I've heard people talk about that. It's like, I want something like, I really like this cymbal, but there's too much of a range in weight. Like the Bounce Ride, for example, I really love the Bounce Ride. It's one of my favorite cymbals. But I've seen some of them that are at like 2,600 grams and some of them that are at like 2,300 grams.
Yeah.
And for me personally, the way I see it, that's just a little bit too much of a range for creating the same sound in
Yeah.
in one line. So if you're talking to Zildjian and you know you're ordering the cymbal and you put in the notes at your dealer saying, you know, I'd like a 22-inch Bounce Ride, just pick one that's as light as possible. Sometimes they're not even going to have the time to do
Yeah.
that. They're not even going to go through the pile. They're not going to go through hundreds and hundreds of Bounce Rides, and which I understand. I'm not begrudging anybody for that. It's just the nature of the business. But we, as independents, we can do that for people. We
Yeah.
can, if somebody, even if we have a cymbal that they like in stock and they're like, yeah, I really love this one, but I, you know, is there any way that we could, if I buy it, could you shave another 100 grams off it or something? And we can do that
Yeah.
for them. So it's something that I've been saying for a while since I started working in music stores and I started seeing a lot of things that work in terms of companies and you know building. It's more with electronics where we talk about planned obsolescence and stuff like that. That doesn't, I don't
Yeah.
know if that really applies to cymbals, but the philosophy kind of applies to with chasing trends and just trying to produce things as cheaply and quickly as possible, and they don't have the time or they don't want to put in the effort to really get something that's going to be a lasting
Yeah.
partner to whatever that musician needs. And that's definitely something that we can do. So that's where I see our value in the market. And I just had a couple people come by this week for modifications on their cymbals, and they really, as musicians, most of us are just gearheads. We like to sit with other drummers and other musicians and just talk about stuff. It's like, hey, have you heard this cymbal? Have you seen this one? Check this one out. So it's part of that personal experience. And we're, you know, whether it's something like cymbal makers or people, or there's a lot of, you see on social media, people who make like custom tables with like the acrylic thing that they pour in the middle. And,
Yeah.
you know, they make really cool designs. But it's going back to the era of personal service and really putting what the customer wants first. And, you know, we can get it more into this too, because sometimes us as the experts in our craft, I hesitate to say that we might know more about what that customer actually wants than what they're telling us, because they're, you know, they might be saying, yeah, I want a 22-inch cymbal that's like 1,800 grams and I want it to wobble like a manta ray. And we're like, okay, hang on a second. Let's talk about it a little bit more and see if there's a way that we can get you something that's going to be a little bit more versatile, or maybe it's not going to crack it within you playing it 25 times. So that's more or less how I think about it, is that we're just, it's as simple as us being able to offer something that the big companies can't. And that's why we're seeing that boom in our niche of the industry.
I agree. Yeah, I think it comes down to, I'd be interested to talk to you about process a little bit, and then also it's the process itself and its time are the two factors that I think that differentiate us from the big guys, which, you know, the whenever you're Paul has talked to us a little bit about when they were making cymbals as at Zildjian. He would make kind of some prototypes and dial in the prototypes, and then he would send the design down to the production floor, and they would figure out how to crank them out in the hundreds or even in the thousands, depending on what line it is. And with that, you just have there's a limitation on, you know, you have the cymbal, you get the cymbal hammered, you do the lathing, it goes to the testing, and that it's just ding, 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 done. Send it out. If it's got defects, it gets sent back. But it's really like a two or three step thing, and I don't know what your process is like, but for me, my process can range from, sometimes it's just hammer, lathe, finish. Other times it's hammer, lathe, hammer, lathe, hammer, lathe, patina, hammer, lathe, finish. You know, there's this layered process to it, which is in the extremes, it is unnecessary to kind of go back and forth a million times. But I find that, like, you know, with any kind of craft or art form, especially music, you have to start out with this attitude that you're going to find the boundaries that you want to exist in. So how thin is too thin? How many layering processes is too many? And then you kind of go all the way out to the extremes. You go too far, you break symbols, you crack symbols, you ruin things, and then you kind of dial it back a little bit and you find your realm, which is a little bit of a different topic, but to me, it's kind of what we all are offering, what we all are doing is we are approaching the craft of making symbols. And some of us are approaching it in the way that musicians approach becoming a musician and finding their voice as an artist.
Yeah.
It's like, you gotta, you know what I mean? You have to practice the technique, but then you also have to develop your ear. Then you have to ask the question, well, okay, I've emulated all my favorites. Who am I? What do I have to say? And then there's this evolution to it like that. And I've noticed that all of my favorite cymbal makers, you could clearly tell that they have their own unique voice, their own unique thing to say. And it's different from the other ones. Like I've said on this podcast before, every single one of us has our own unique voice in, like, none of us are making the exact same cymbals. We all kind of have our own take. And if you want a certain vibe, you might connect more with another maker because of it. It's their voice, it's their ears, what they're hearing and what they want to actualize in the metal. So, so what is your voice? What would you describe if you had to say, like, what sound are you chasing after?
I definitely like the high profile, thin, trashy kind of stuff. That's definitely what I think I excel in. But I'm always, whatever sound I'm kind of chasing, something I'm always looking for, the word in my mind is balance every time. I'm looking for something that's going to give you what you need, even if it's kind of on the extreme end of, you know, if it's kind of super dark and trashy and umbrella profiled, and or if it's the other way, like I'm just going to be releasing in the next couple days now, I'm going to be releasing a Kenny Clarke tribute ride, which is kind of the total opposite of what my sound generally is. It's a 17 inch cymbal that's fairly heavy and it's not hammered really hard. It's just trying to really kind of maintain those sparkly tones that you hear on the records kind of in the 50s before that magic cymbal was stolen. So, but no matter what I'm making, balance is key. I want a nice balanced pitch. I don't want any wobble to it. I want the cymbal to be able to be used in a number of different settings, depending on who's using it and what they want to use it for. Like if you want a nice, clean sounding jazz ride, I want you to also be able to take that to, you know, a funk gig and kind of lay into it as a big crash or something. Like I don't want my cymbals to ever really be put into some kind of a category. And that's where my mindset is with that for the most part. It's the idea of balance and not letting the scale tip too far towards one side where people are playing the cymbal and they're thinking, yeah, this is really good for this, but I would never be able to use it for something else. You know what I mean? Yeah. That's kind of my idea behind that for the most part. Of course, if somebody wants something that's going to really, if somebody doesn't like metal music, for example, and they really just want a nice jazz ride that they're not going to use for anything else, hey, that's great. But for the most part, I want myself to be able to stretch.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, I'm kind of in that same zone. I talk about a spectrum a lot where you have versatile on this side and inspiring, for lack of a better term, on this side. And they're different. And then so if you go too far into the inspiring, you know, funky, original, unique kind of thing, it ends up becoming more and more unusable the farther you go in that direction. So yeah, it's like the super thin cymbals that we all see that wobble a ton. And like you were alluding to, it's like that cymbal's going to, the second you start digging in, it's going to break apart and you're not going to be able to hear any of the patterns. You're just going to hear this white noise craziness. But maybe at, you know, a pianissimo volume, it's going to be great. Maybe if you took that cymbal and put a piece of tape on it and took it to a cafe gig with tons of brick everywhere, it'd be perfect.
Yeah.
And then on the far end, it's like the ping ride, you know, the super heavy manhole cover that goes ding and that's all it does. And
yeah,
that works great for rock and roll. If you need to cut through some Marshall stacks or, you know, whatever. I don't know if people still use Marshall stacks, but if you need to, this is why they were made in the 80s and 90s. It's like they needed cymbals to cut through. Well, really the 70s through the 90s, they needed cymbals to cut through these big loud amps.
Yeah.
So and you have this. Yeah, go ahead.
Oh, sorry. I was just going to add to that, thinking like with the whole Marshall stack thing, it's like, that's something that I will generally ask people when I'm making them a cymbal. I'm thinking, okay, when you send me a sound file or a record or whatever it is that you want this cymbal to kind of be modeled after or sound like, the most important question is, do you want it to sound like that when you record it? Or do you want it to sound like that when you're sitting right in front of it? Because those are two very different cymbals.
Exactly. Yeah.
And that's talking about mixing with Marshall stacks and everything like that. You hear that ping ride. And for me, that's not really a sound that I'm super into. So I hear like really heavy kind of machine made cymbals.
Yep.
Like A and CB, double A, stuff like that. And they just don't work well for me. But then you listen to some old rock stuff and you hear that bell piercing through the electric guitars. And it's like, that's, you couldn't find a more perfect sound for that, just right. because it doesn't work for me sitting in my right here, not, you know, playing to myself, doesn't mean it's not going to work for every situation. So that's, it's always important to let people know that.
Yeah. There's the environment that you need it to function in. There's a very practical functionality of it. And then there's also the element of what, which I find the difficult thing, like you alluded again to almost needing to train our customers, or like we're in a position where we know a lot about cymbals, and a lot of people that come to us wanting cymbals just know what they know. It's not a shame thing at all. It's like, they just know that they only know as far as like the cymbals they've bought and played and what they've heard and what they've listened to. And oftentimes there's this gap between like people, what they think they want and what they might need.
Yeah.
And then there's also another concept that I've been trying to flesh out about like a drum room cymbal versus a gigging cymbal and how they're different. You know, like the cymbal that you're going to love in your drum room, this is overgeneralizing to a crazy degree, but the cymbal that you will love to sit behind in your drum room is oftentimes going to be something that just doesn't hurt your ears as much. So it's going to tend to be maybe darker sounding, maybe a little bit thinner. You know, it's going to be something that you can lay into and it doesn't have that super piercing thing. But then when you go to a gig and you play outdoors and you need that cymbal to translate, and maybe you don't have microphones, it's like that cymbal is not going to function well. So as artists, as drummers, I'm only saying this because I have personally gone through at this point, probably over 20 year journey of trying to figure out what is my sound, what is the cymbal sound that I want to attain. And it has taken 20 years to really start to get a grasp on what I need for certain environments, because I've literally had hundreds of, you know, over maybe thousands of cymbals come through my shop that I've played. So I have enough experience to know, okay, this is good for this gig, this is good for this gig. If I want to do a certain thing, this is what I need. And it's really confusing. I think that's another thing that we offer as makers, is we offer the ability to, for lack of a better term, you guys can come and pick our brains as to what might be best for you. So there, you have your sound in your head, which is good. Take that, but then incorporate maybe some of these other concepts of, how hard do you hit? Where do you see yourself playing that instrument? And that we can put in little things that help the cymbal translate well for exactly what the player is wanting to do and accomplish.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's like, I feel like some of my customers maybe get annoyed with me sometimes, because I teach music as well. So I kind of have that teacher element to my personality. So they're just coming over to get some weight shaved off of a cymbal. And I'm like, stopping lathing, turning around, and was like, yeah, so what this does is, dude, just lay the cymbal, just get it done. But what I was talking about before is like, we're at some level, we're all gearheads, we're all, you know, musicians at the end of the day. So that's what's separate, different about our industry, where you can do that kind of thing. Like, where if you go to a, you go to a factory where somebody's, you know, making little metal washers for mass distribution or grommets or what, you know, whatever they might do, and somebody starts talking about, yeah, so this part of this little washer is different because of this, whatever. I, you know, not to be rude, but I think most people are kind of like, yeah, I don't really care.
I don't care.
Put the washer under the screw and screw it into what it needs to do. But that's where we, working in an artistic vein of something that's production based, so we're still using a lot of those same kind of ideas of people who, you know, people who work in factories, and, you know, symbols are made no matter how small or big it is, like my garage, your workshop, like those are technically factories,
right?
So it's the same kind of idea, but, you know, you don't see a lot of people wanting to take tours of Maersk or something like that.
Yeah.
People will wait and pay and do all this stuff to try to get into a symbol factory for a tour. So that's,
yeah,
that's kind of why I don't feel bad talking my customers' ears off about it. Sometimes it's like, I know you want to hear this. Let me tell you this real quick. It's cool, I promise.
Right. Yeah. I think it's important because it really does. I mean, I think it's important because my playing hit a different level when I started making instruments. I started to understand, like, when you understand your instrument a little bit more, just a little bit more, it actually really does open up so much. It opens your mind to so much more that you didn't really realize was possible beforehand. Like, I was always, before 2015, I was always saving up all my money to buy the next instrument, the drum set, the cymbal, whatever it was, that I thought would be the instrument that I could really get my sound out of. And I'd spend a lot of money, and it really is all comes down to, you know, whatever company had the best marketing and whatever company had the best artist that was, you know, my favorite artist plays such and such. So, you know, for me, it was Gretsch. I was going to get a USA custom Gretsch drum kit, Gretsch drums. I got no problem with Gretsch drums, but I spent all this money on a USA custom kit, and it was nice, but it didn't do what I needed it to do. I was looking for more of a old school vintage sound. And I wasn't getting it from the USA custom. And it wasn't until I started building that I realized, oh, okay, the bearing edges on that USA custom is they're modern. They're meant to project. They're meant to be brighter. And they had a little bit of a pingy sound that I really couldn't stand. Obviously, all that stuff can be dialed out with tuning and whatnot, but head selection, dampening, all that stuff. But it was like getting into the nitty gritty of the instrument really allowed me to realize, okay, what kind of drum set do I need to get? What kind of bearing edges do I need? Then that dictates what kind of heads I'm going to choose, what kind of tuning I'm going to do. Then on top of that, how I'm going to pull the sound out of the drums. And then, so drums are so much more, you know, simple, because it's just, you know, you can manipulate them so many ways. Cymbals are what they are. And so when it got time to, like, for me to start down that path, it was like what I just described on steroids. It was like a whole nother level of, there no two cymbals are going to sound the same. And, you know, in a lot of ways, the big companies have had to just kind of water down how beautiful the instrument is. They have to water it down to a point where they can sort of replicate things.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like
taking,
I feel like a lot of the beauty can be stripped out of the instrument by the process of mass production. That's just my opinion. I'm not trying to, like, you know, that's not like not meant to be like a hot take or anything, but I think it's just getting back to it. It's like the process that these instruments go through to become what they are is a little bit more watered down, one dimensional. Whereas, you know, I can take a cymbal that, you know, is finished, and I can go in and hammer it once and change the character. Or if it has one little issue, like a couple taps on the underside or a burnish on the top or whatever it is, and then it can kind of fine tune, dial it right where it needs to be, which is why I do a lot of modifications. I'm sure you do a lot of modifications for that same reason, is these cymbals that are just cranked out. I mean, there are some, I had one last week where it was a nicer cymbal from one of the big name brands, kind of in the jazz cymbal vein. And I got it, put it on the floor of my shop, kind of pressed around the bell. It had this really big soft area. and I turned it around. I hammered three strikes, flipped it back over, felt it. Okay, we're feeling pretty good. Put it on the stand, played it. And then I was like, I think that's done. Put it aside, come back, and it's finished. It's like, it really, yeah. It needed three hammer strikes to dial it to where it wanted to be, where the symbol itself wanted to be, so that it would sing and sound the best that it could. And
yeah,
that's the beauty of it. It's like there's that you can get as micro with it as you want, or you can kind of zoom out and create all these different designs. It's really kind of a point of that ramble is just to say that it's cymbals are a fascinating instrument, and I think they are more complex and more beautiful than people think they are, just because they're only used to the big box version exactly. of them, you know?
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. I totally agree with that. It's kind of a shame sometimes when people, they don't, you know, they think about cymbals and they, you know, they think about the, you know, the cheap cymbals that came with their kit that they never replaced. And because they don't know that, you know, that it's a huge sound. It's basically our entire color palette, like how we have for drummers, like that can completely change everything about how you sound, and it can completely change everything about how you play. Like how you're saying too, you get a new cymbal and people start changing their hand technique. They start doing all this stuff that they never really thought of before. And that's part of the inspiration that comes from having something that's handmade and something that, you know, was kind of tailor-made for you.
Question for you.
Couldn't have said it better.
So I've noticed that you have, you've posted about a jam session that's around your area, I'm guessing.
Yes.
And you show, you bring your cymbals, you put your cymbals up, and you watch drummer after drummer get up there and play them. What have you noticed from a cymbal maker's perspective? What have you noticed by going through that process, doing it multiple times? Like what are the biggest takeaways from taking your instruments that you make, putting them on a drum set, and watching other drummers play them?
The big thing is just positioning, like where you are. If I'm sitting at the table over here by the door, if I'm sitting at the bar, the cymbal sounds completely different. And I never realized as well, because I play my cymbals kind of up and angled. Yeah. You can see there, they're pretty high and they're angled. So when I hear people playing them there, I never realized how much sound of the cymbal, the projection, it's similar to a drum, how they're built to project forward with the sound. I've never realized how much of cymbals are like that too.
Yeah.
Where you play, I'm sitting here like this, hearing somebody play this cymbal from this angle, and I'm almost hearing more stick definition and more wash coming through here than I am when I'm sitting there beside it, which is something that I've never really thought about as well. So trying to think about ways that I can get projection and presence with the cymbal without making it too much of a clangy tone, or I'm trying not to step on the elements of the cymbal of the sound that I like, while trying to get to a sound that's going to project a little bit more. And sometimes at that jam session, you know, when we start off, usually like it's a trio that starts it off, a guitar, bass, and drums trio. And sometimes when I'm lucky enough to sit in subbing for that gig, so I get to play a few songs in the beginning before the horn players and that everybody gets up, I get to kind of hear the cymbal in different settings right there within a few minutes. So usually you're seeing, it's like, okay, the good thing about a jam session is the fact that you're getting a changing lineup constantly. So like within 10 minutes, I can hear, okay, how does the cymbal sound with the trio? How does the cymbal sound with five horn players? So you know, people standing all around and you're buried in the back. Does that cymbal have enough power to get through that? And more often than not, with some of the earlier cymbals that I made, it just wasn't. As soon as one saxophone player got up there, it just couldn't. It couldn't hang. It couldn't take it. So it's trying to get to a point where, like I said before, you can keep the qualities of the cymbal that you like, but make sure that everyone is hearing them evenly. Because I do like, I like dry cymbals. I always have. I like the unlathed look and everything. I like heavy patinas, getting to see every individual hammer mark. I really like that. But it's always been a source of pain for me that they just don't work in most scenarios. It's sad, but you know, you try to bring a big old dry cymbal and like I just said, as soon as one horn player gets up there, you're done. You're hearing stick and nothing.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that's kind of what I'm thinking about. That's the blessing, I guess, that I have as a maker to be able to be in that situation. I have to be honest with myself sometimes and just be able to say, okay, as much as I love that cymbal in my shop, it just doesn't work.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it's, you
and
know,
that's the exact thing I'm talking about with like the drum room cymbal and then the cymbal for the gig. It's
yeah.
They really are different things. And one thing I've been thinking about a lot recently is like there are many, many times where it's like, okay, I want to make heavier cymbals and I'll make a cymbal that's 22 inches, 2,700 grams, and I'll sit down and play it. And then in my room here, it's like, I'll play it and kind of go, oh, it's too pingy. And I'll put it aside or whatever. But I've learned over the years that the all of the nuance and the grit and the complexity and the beauty that we are searching for is in that symbol, even though you can't even hear it. There are times where it's in there. You just don't know because you're just standing right on top of it. Or maybe you're not using the kind of stick that's going to draw it out. Or like you were saying, it's not angled on the cymbal stand in a way that's going to benefit that. It's, you know, there's so many factors to it. But what'll happen is those cymbals, then maybe they get taken to a gig or I let a buddy of mine borrow them or one of my artists take them on a few shows. And then I'll go listen to it and go, oh, all of that complexity is there. I just needed to step away from the cymbal to realize it.
Yep.
You know, like I think the big example of when I first encountered this weird paradox was when I really got into Bill Stewart's playing and really was like, oh my God, his cymbals sound unbelievable. Yeah. And I was like, I've got to find a dry complex to purchase. I have to get that cymbal because that's the sound. And I finally found one and I bought one and it was in the gram weight range that's, you know, right in the range that Bill plays. And I play it and I go, oh God, this is awful. I was like playing it behind it, like it was hurting my ears. It was just all like angry, pingy, loud is all it was. And it was just, and then I slowly started to realize, okay, when you take into account the bands he's playing in, the stick that he uses, the technique that he has, the recording techniques that are typically used on his records and the records that when he's playing with Scofield. I mean, even just that trio, the Scofield trio, that's a loud, really loud trio. And so, you know, for him to cut through Scofield's guitar and Steve Swallow's bass, it takes like weight to that cymbal. And so it's got the umbrella curvature. It's got the topography to it to give it that hissy, angry growl. But it has all this extra weight that I wasn't really used to sitting behind and hearing from behind the kit. It was like, it was too much for me. And it was too much for the gigs that I was playing. I took it to the gig and it was the saxophone player was like, oh God, please stop playing that cymbal. And it was like within like four bars of the first tune, it was like he literally turned around with a disgusted look, not like the good stank face look, like, oh
yeah,
really bad.
He's vibing you out.
Very much so. And so it became like, okay, that also kind of started me on this idea, which I'm interested to know what you think about this. One thing that's been inspiring to me as a maker is the pursuit. I don't know if I'm landing it all the time, but the pursuit of incorporating factors or specs into a cymbal that shouldn't work together or don't necessarily like, for instance, like make, you know, the easy one to say is like make a thin cymbal that sounds heavy or make a heavy cymbal that sounds thin, like incorporate factors that are opposite to the actual design of your cymbal and try to incorporate those characteristics into it. Like, kind of do the impossible is maybe a way of saying it simply. It's like, do the impossible with this symbol. That's been super inspiring to me as far as just searching after different sounds and trying to find new ways of making the instrument, new ways of drawing out certain characteristics in heavy symbols and thin symbols and all everywhere in between. So do you think about anything like that in your process? Like, cause you talk a lot about needing the stick clarity and like these, you have these like this checklist, it seems, of the things that your symbols need to accomplish. And then beyond that, it's all the flavoring and the color that you can put into it.
Yeah, it's kind of like the stuff that you've talked about before in terms of trying to eliminate things like soft spots in a symbol in a certain way that you're, you know, the symbol has the strength that it needs to have a nice even sound, and it's not just going to be like your, you know, the image I always think in my mind is like when you're, you know, when you're a kid and you see a nice smooth pool or a puddle or something and you kind of slap it and all the water kind of goes like that. That's how I feel about symbols that have really bad soft spots, like a lot, some of the bigger company symbols that have really low profiles and they're really thin as well. You can't ride on them at all. Like this, it just completely, it splats outwards instead of giving you what you want back to you. It's all that kind of sound.
Interesting. I like that.
But there's, in terms of a checklist, I'm always trying to work with what that piece of bronze kind of seems like it wants to be without trying to sound too, I guess, overly spiritual about it. Like that piece of bronze is meant to be something. I'm kind of trying to find that. And it's interesting what you're talking about in terms of having opposite things mixed together to create something more, I guess. I was just, not yesterday, but the day before, I was doing a modification for a local drummer where he had a super heavy old A. This is something that I get a lot, just an old A from the 90s or before, like a, you know, an A 20 inch medium ride or something that's just, it's just not usable, especially since it has more of a patina now, which has made it heavy, but also a lot more dry.
Yeah.
So it's not even really usable for what it was intended for anymore. But we were getting to a point where I was thinking, okay, in order to get more smoothness and evenness out of this symbol, I'm going to have to hammer it a lot heavier and get a little bit more topography on it. Cause right now there's a huge separation between the highs and the lows. And while we usually think of really heavy hammering giving you a lot more complexity, that is true. But when you have a lot of separation between those highs and lows, that heavier hammering can create this bridge between them that makes everything sort of feel like it works together instead of having a low drone and a high ping on top of it, if that makes sense. So that's
definitely,
that's the first thing that came to my mind when you think about that is like heavy, as you would call it, like topography hammering.
Yeah.
To create smoothness.
Interesting. Yeah. Which it's I haven't thought of it in that way, to be honest. But I can see what you mean. It's like, I did the exact same thing to an old A last week. It was like, you know, it came in at 2,600 grams for 20 inch symbol. And it was like, okay, this guy wants it, you know, he wants it thinner, but you know, you take those umbrella symbols with big bells and you lay them really thin and they sound just so awful. Like an overly thin old A is one of my least favorite sounds in the world. A lot of it's like if you lay the bell too thin, especially, it's like a big bell that's also too thin and hollow is utter garbage to me, at least. But what I did was, it was this, you know, I did exactly that. It was like, I got to a point where I felt like the bell was still strong. There's still enough stick clarity, but I was opening up that like ka kind of umbrella shaped tonality that was being opened up, but it still had this wide separation between the chimey old A thing and then the low drone thing, and that hammering, that complexity hammering, kind of like it bridges the gap between those two sounds and makes the whole thing almost like it just sounds more cohesive. Like the symbol is not doing two opposite weird things. It's kind of it feels like a cohesive sound. So that's one side of it, and then the other side of it is oftentimes I try to, and I don't really know how to conceptualize this in conversation, but I think about, a lot of times I think about trying to scoop out mid-range and create separation. Like, so there's times when it's too much, and then there's times where you actually need more of it. You need more distance because everything can feel like it's all here and nothing is clear and you got a lot of mud. So there's, again, it's like a range. There's a spectrum on one end and the other of, of what makes a good sounding cymbal to my ear, at least. What do you think about that concept? Maybe on the other side of that coin, where you're actually trying to take a muddy, and for instance, it'd be like a low shaped, like you were saying, a low shaped cymbal that's too thin. You know, it's just too much mud. Everything is too jumbled together, and it needs that separation.
Yeah, for me, usually what fixes that problem is a little bit of a profile raise and getting some stiffness back into the cymbal, because that's pretty much, it's the mixture of the low drone of the cymbal, which those cymbals are all low drone. There's nothing else to them. So when you raise the profile up a little bit, but not so much that you're going to get an umbrella and you're going to create this gongy overtone to it, which the dry complex, those cymbals have, like, that's their main kind of quality. They're very gongy. But that's kind of the thing for me, is like, I want to create it's kind of like adding more highs, pulling some of the lows out of there and getting them to be a higher pitch, if that makes sense.
Yes.
It's a lot. So, like, some of the stuff is so hard to talk about.
It's so hard.
I
was thinking, what I'll do, I'm going to do some very crude drawings, and then anyone who's watching this on YouTube maybe can, like, actually look and see. God, these are going to be so bad. I'm so bad at drawing. So we'll just do our best.
Same here, man.
Oh God, that was terrible. I'm going to have to try multiple times.
No, you're good.
Okay. So, all right. I need to do it bigger here. This is what we're going to do.
Yeah.
I've never done this on one of the podcasts. So I can actually do some drawing.
We're breaking new ground here, man.
Breaking new ground, indeed. Okay. Yeah. All right. So we talk about profile, and we have, this is my scribble where I messed up the first time. And
I mean, I'd buy that symbol. That looks great.
Yeah. See, right. So this would be something that I would consider, like, this makes sense to me. I like this because there's a consistent curvature from the base of that bell out. But that's not always what you want. That's not, like, the right way to make a cymbal. There's a million ways to make a cymbal. So we could have, you know, we could do some things where, say, we do this. Okay. Again, very terrible. But okay, so now it's less consistent, but we have, like, this hook at the edge and it kind of flattens out. So that can be a cool sound, but if it's too far and you have this going on, then this is utter garbage. This is, like, not what you want to see. And you could translate out this hyper curvature, like, say it just flattens out here, but you still have this kind of tendency towards it dipping at the bell. Which is a lot of those low shaped cymbals, they just don't have enough of a profile to have strength there.
Yep.
You know, absolutely. So it's like, so being able to create something that has strength up near the bell, which means it might be a little bit more triangular or might have, like, a little bit more of a curvature upwards, it's going to raise the pitch, because anything that's flat and low, I'm obviously not talking to you, you know this. This is talking to the listeners here. It's like anything that's flat is going to tend to be low frequency, and the more you draw it up into a profile, the higher that pitch is going. But also it's also limiting its ability to flap and throw off sound. So these low shaped things will have a low fundamental, but they will easily, the cymbal will be easily activated. So technically sound, it's easier for the sound to travel. So a crash cymbal or, like, a washy ride is typically a lower shape. It's typically, so it's got low fundamental and the ability to spread or crash. And the more it goes up, you're also choking that ability for the cymbal to kind of move at the edges and throw off that sound. And everywhere in between, like, totally flat, I won't do any more drawing. That was terrible. low and flat, anywhere between this and then the ultra umbrella, there's this playground that we have in between those two worlds. And that to me is, like, the most fascinating part about cymbals, is, like, you have unbelievable amounts of crazy amounts of variables that go into how it sounds. Yeah. And you can change any one variable and get a totally different sound. And that's kind of, like, speaking of the paradox, it's like is it possible to make a really low shaped symbol that's super strong? And it's like, that's a challenge.
That's something that I was, that's something that I was going to mention as well. Like I did a modification a while back on a 1980s 18 inch K heavy ride.
Yeah.
And that symbol, they're trying to create, I see what they were doing. And I remember thinking to myself, okay, this symbol is like 18 inches and it's like 2,300 grams. I'm going to hate it. This is going to be the worst symbol ever.
That's the GAD symbol, right?
I think so. But then I got a stick to it and I was like, huh, I was making a mistake that a lot of people tend to do, which is I was only looking at one aspect of what this symbol is and drawing a conclusion from there. So I just heard 18 inch, 2,300 grams. This is a piece of crap. It's not going to sound good. But then it had a nice big bell. It had a lot of separation between the bell and the bow, mm-hmm. which in my mind gives me more. That's one of the biggest aspects that gives me separation between the highs and the lows. If you have a very integrated bell, that gives you, that raises the fundamental and gives you a lot of mid-range that starts to mix everything together, which is a sound that I like, but sometimes, you know, sometimes you don't need that. But it had a lot of separate, big bell, heavy, lots of separation between there. And then there was almost no curvature to it at all. Yeah. It was very low and kind of flat, but it had the weight behind it that it was able to have some strength. And when I was playing it with this, with the, just when I got a stick to it, I was like, wow, this actually doesn't sound bad at all. Like it's got a low pitch, but there's also highs to it because of the weight and the size of the bell and that separation we were talking about. So this symbol does have a lot of good qualities, but I was making the mistake that a lot of people who, myself included, I've fallen for this a million times where you're buying a symbol online and you're looking at it and you think, okay, what's the weight? 22 inches, 25? Too heavy for me.
Yeah.
And then it's funny too, because when you started releasing a lot more heavier cymbals and started experimenting with that, one part of my brain was like, oh, Tim, don't leave us, man. What are you doing?
But
then the more I heard you talk about it and the more I heard the cymbals and I started, you know, clicking on some of the drummers that you were posting that were playing some of those cymbals. And I was listening to them and I was like, wow, I could not have been more wrong in my initial knee jerk reaction to that, which is still me thinking about like one of the, it was probably like the third or fourth cymbal that I made. And it was before I even had my lathe. So I was just hammering these really, really thin blanks into shape, which I feel like is where we all started.
Yeah.
And then it's like, I had that moment there where you finish it. It's like really high profile. It's kind of, in a way, it's not a very nice cymbal, even though it accomplishes something that it accomplished a step that every cymbal smith needs to get past.
Yeah.
And I listened to it. I was getting my stick on. I was like, oh, that's Tony Williams right there. I nailed it. Yeah. Third cymbal. This is easy.
Yeah.
But then now that I go back and listen to that same reaction, I was like, man, I could not have possibly been more wrong about my initial reaction to that cymbal and the way I was going about making it. So it's, it kind of went on a little bit of a tangent there, but it lends itself to the idea of another thing that I'm telling a lot of customers. It's like, when people ask me, it's like, what would this, if you did, you know, if you brought the weight down a little bit on this symbol, what would that do? And I always have to step back and say, well, the weight of a symbol has a certain function if all other variables remain the same.
Yeah.
But if you change anything else, then it changes the fact of how the weight is going to interact with the rest of those things. So if you have a symbol that's, if say something's 2,500 grams, but it's a little bit looser in its stiffness and it has some heavier hammering and the bell is a lot smaller versus a cymbal that's 300 grams lighter, but it's got this big massive bell and it's a kind of a more smooth surface to it. The weight alone is not going to be something that's going to be able to tell you what the difference is between those two cymbals. You're going to hear the other one and think that it's heavier.
Right.
Which is, that's a whole rabbit hole in itself. But that was something that I think watching one of Nicky Moon's little Instagram videos that he makes sometimes where he's just talking to the camera really turned me on to that idea. He was saying like, when you're by, he was in his way, you know, his endearing way of just talking very directly and saying, look, this is what you're thinking about a symbol, and this is why it's wrong.
Yeah.
And I took that and I was like, man, how could I be wrong about something like that? But he was, you know, he really turned me on to that idea of like, the weight isn't everything. And no matter how often you scream that from the rooftops, there's always people who are going to reject a symbol simply because they see that number they don't like.
Yeah.
And that's that big plateau, that big stepping stone that symbolsmiths have to get over, and people buying symbols, do players in general, everybody, like the sound is the sound. When you start looking really, really deeply into what it is, you can, you know, you start to get in your head and you can trip yourself up. Like, I don't care if the symbol is 2,700 grams. Does it sound good?
Yeah.
Then it's a good symbol.
Yeah.
That's it.
Exactly. Yeah. What you're talking about, I mean, I feel like the weight, I try to say this about the weight to people when they're asking me about things or they're wanting my advice. I say, think of the weight like you think of the size. Mm-hmm. Does you know, when I say 22 inches, does one symbol sound come to your mind?
Nope.
There's a million different kinds of sounds that a 22 can have. So the weight is kind of like that. It's almost as like, think of it as the starting point. And, you know, I tell people like gram weights are not insignificant. They're just a starting point. Yeah, so
exactly. It's
like, have your range, like figure out what your range is. Like I like a 21 inch and I like it to range between 2,100 grams and 2,300 grams. That's where I like my 21s. And then put that aside and deal with the real meat of it, which is what's the shape, what's the bell, what's the lathing like, does it have a patina, you know, what's the taper like.
Yep.
All of that stuff is going to dictate more of the sound than just you saying, I want a 21 that's exactly 2,005 grams. And that's what I want. Make me something like that. And it's like, well, I can, but it could hit the mark or it could be wildly off because there's so many other factors.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like a symbol. A symbol is supposed to be a whole that's greater than the sum of its parts. Just like other things too. I tell that to my students all the time when we're talking about, you know, drummers, especially young drummers that I teach, is like, there's always a tendency to play really loud and you learn a couple of cool licks and you want to stick them in everywhere. And make sure it's like, and I try to drill into their heads, like you are not a drummer when you step on that bandstand, for lack of a better idea of how to conceptualize it. You're a band member. You're not just a drummer who's, you know, posting on Instagram, trying to get follows and everything like that. You are serving the song, which is everything. It's everything that you're trying to do right now. If you make a bad choice, you know, and that bad choice is kind of that's another rabbit hole. It's like, you know, some people, you hear a drum fill and somebody's like, that's the coolest fill I've ever heard and it sounds perfect for the song. And then other people don't like it, but that's besides the point. It's you are trying to serve the song as the drummer, just in the way that if you squeeze that down and look at the individual instruments, that symbol that we make is trying to serve the drummer in a way that they can serve the song. So there's different levels of, you know, service that you're trying to provide to everything. And then you can go even further from the song too. The song is supposed to serve what the idea of the full album is supposed to be, which is supposed to serve the idea of what the artist themselves is trying to put forth into the world. So there's infinite ways that you can think of it in either way. But when you start to think of these kind of things selfishly, for lack of a better term, I'm not trying to call anybody selfish, obviously, but you know, it really is supposed to be from the idea of service to the music. That's where we all come from, whether you're a cymbal maker or a player or a sales guy trying to get somebody the right thing that they need for their music.
Right.
That's where I land with that idea. And the weight, like the weight is just one thing that lends itself to that. Like you said, it's important, but it's not everything. That's why when we're selling a cymbal, it's not like I just post a black picture, nothing. And then it's, you know, this cymbal is 2,200 grams and whatever. You got to see what's the hammering and lathing like, what you look at from the side, so you can see the profile and the bell shape. And then when you look at all that stuff and then you read the weight makes a lot more sense as if it would in a vacuum.
Right. Yeah, I agree. I like that the service to the song, service to, there's the cymbal needs to serve the drummer serving the song, which is serving the out, you know, it kind of,
yeah.
I think that the difficult thing being, you know, maybe we could talk a little bit about the negative aspects of COVID and social media and how we've all kind of like gone into our own worlds, is that there's a danger of us losing the connection that we have between each person or each musician, and we're not playing as much music together. We're kind of playing music on our own and maybe posting clips of us playing. And
it's
just something to check yourself with, where it's like, if you find yourself too focused on just what you play, how you play, your technique, blah, 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 whatever, it's just something to keep yourself in check with, because I will say, from my personal experience, I played music for many years. I did a little bit of touring. I did a bunch of recording sessions. I was not the best drummer around. I did not have the most chops. I did not have the most, like, whatever. I feel like I never thought I was that good. And so I was like, the best I can do is just at least execute, like at least just execute the song, or, you know, play that groove with, you know, play it with a good feel, play it with good time, like these very basic things. Cause I never felt like I had the ability to go beyond that into the world of exploration and chops and all this kind of craziness. And that ended up serving me well, because I would get gigs over people that were far better than me, far better. And it was like, just because I would be focusing on the simple things, I focused a lot on my gear. I was a total gearhead. Everything that I brought, I brought way too much stuff to recording sessions. And those little things served me well. And I don't know, I think I didn't do it intentionally. I think I kind of just fell into it. And I'm now, in retrospect, that I don't do as many gigs and I don't do as many recording sessions, I'm able to kind of see, like, that's why I was able to do it, because I was deficient in these areas of my technique and my ability as a drummer. I was deficient. So it's,
same
it's
with me.
It's a good thing to think about. And the people that I feel like, if I had kept at it as a player, I could have really achieved, you know, I could have achieved maybe like a high status as an in-demand session player, or like gotten a big gig or whatever. It's possible, you know, it's possible for any of us. Because I think the people that maybe start out and focus their energy towards executing things well, or serving the song, serving the music, creating a cohesive sound on their drum kit. And then if you do that out of a lack of self-confidence, but then if you catch the bug and you get really obsessed with that, then some of the deepest artists, best drummers I've ever heard are like Steve Gadd. Like, the way that Steve Gadd plays the simplest beat ever, if you listen to him with James Taylor, or you listen to him with Paul Simon or whoever it is, just play a simple groove. No one plays a groove like Steve Gadd plays a groove, you know?
Yep, absolutely.
And there's so much like depth to that level of artistry. And I try to think about like the manufacturing of my cymbals. Could I make cymbals that are really understated, but have mastery to them in some way? Like a cymbal that you're going to hit and it's not going to be the one that you kind of like, that makes you go, oh wow, I got to have that. It kind of goes, you hit it and you're like, oh yeah, okay. But then you hear it in the band context and it's like, it's the perfect thing, you know? So it's like, maybe there's also another spectrum of like flashy, you know, like the flashy attention getting type of thing. Yeah. And then the utilitarian type of thing that's really going to get the job done.
Yeah,
but can you marry those two, or marry utilitarian with a sense of mastery? Like, again, I'm just rambling, but that's kind of that's a little bit of my process, or the way that I think about cymbals and music. And there's so much to that, I think. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, the first thing that came to my mind when you're talking about that is like, it's just the same. It's the same as a relationship with any person that you have in your life, friends or, you know, a romantic relationship. There are some people who you really get along with, right? You meet them at a party or something and you guys are like hanging out the whole time and take pictures together, the whole thing. It's like, but then a couple months later, you don't talk, you know, you have no idea who they are. But then there's the people who you meet them and it's kind of like, yeah, whatever. This person's kind of whatever. And then next thing you know, you're best friends 10 years later, because you guys have grown in a certain way together. You've had certain experiences. And it's the same way with the symbol. Like, there's certain symbols where I, you know, you hit them, like you said, and you're like, wow, that's incredible. I got to have it right now. I can't tell you how many times that's happened where it's like, yeah, this symbol is a lifer for me. This is unbelievable. And then 6 months later, it's on Facebook Marketplace.
Yeah.
Because it's lost whatever it has to me. But then there's other symbols where I get them. Like this one here. This is a 20-inch new stamp old K.
Cool.
That I got probably, I think it was sometime last year or maybe 2 years ago now. I don't remember. But it was, I played it for the first time. And I was like, yeah, that's kind of cool. It's got what I needed to do. It's an interesting symbol for sure. But now 2 years later, every single time, like, it barely leaves my kit. Every single time I play it, it has something that just draws me to it. And I've learned about the soft spots and the hard spots and sweet spots and everything. I've learned how to play that symbol in a way that I can get what I need out of it. And it's so much more versatile than it seems right there in the moment. And it's, yeah, like that's what you want in a symbol. You want something that's going to have lasting fulfillment, just like other things in life. You don't want to just keep bouncing from one thing to another. And you know, trying to always find what the newest and best and most wowing thing possibly is. It's two sides to the same thing, I guess. It's like, it's something that gives you happiness in the moment, and then something that grows with you and you really become a part of it. And that's something that I feel like a lot of people, myself included, I used to have, you know, 30, 40, 50 symbols I was buying and selling all the time. I used to have a lot at a time, and I would put a rad symbol up, play it on the same spot, same way, same hand, same stick, everything, and then go, okay, I need a different sound, and switch the symbol. I wouldn't think, okay, I need a different sound, so let me experiment a little bit with this. Let me try a different stick. Let me play somewhere different on the symbol. So that's what really inspires me about a lot of the old jazz musicians, like guys like Art Taylor. Art Taylor had one cymbal set. That's it. He had two cymbals and some hi-hats. That's all. But the what he was able to get out of those, because he knew them so intimately, he'd been playing them for 50 years. That's something that, you know, someone like myself and most people in the age that we're living in, with oversaturation of just everything, market and information and everything, that's something we can only really dream of. And that's part of, I think, why we look back to those great musicians. It's like, how was he able to play the same cymbal and get this sound over here that's radically different from this sound?
Yeah.
And that's something that I think people need to really experiment with a little bit more.
I agree. Yeah. It begs the question, like, how do you get to that point? And I don't have an answer for it, but like, maybe we could just yap on a little bit about, like, how do you see past, I mean, the question I have for myself is, how do I see past those flashy things that kind of hit me in the moment? Like, whoa, this is interesting. How do I see past that? Because you're right. Those symbols, whenever I had those symbols that I loved on first touch, many times they would find themselves being sold just a month later, a couple months later, or I would keep them. Like the Dry Complex, I kept for years because I was like, it's the Bill Stewart symbol. I can't get rid of it. But I never played it on gigs. I never played it. It sat in my bag. I did nothing with it until finally I was like, okay, this thing has been sitting for like 2-3 years. I haven't played it on a gig in well over a year. I'm just going to sell it, you know? Like, how do we get to that point of being able to, like, I guess it's a question of discernment. And it's a question of our ears, how well our ears are dialed. But, and then it's also probably societal in a way, because like you were saying, there's all this stuff coming at us, all this flashy marketing and stuff that's hitting us. Like, you need this, you need to buy this, you know?
Exactly.
It's like, how do we become the type of people that can be more discerning, I guess, is the easy way to say it.
For sure. Yeah. It's a, like you said before, it's a question that doesn't really have too much of an answer, but we can poke at it from a couple different angles. Like one thing that I struggled with earlier on was, it's kind of like an ego thing. It's like, this symbol might not sound perfect to what I really needed to do, but I like it when I open up my cymbal bag and there's another drummer there that says, "Whoa, is that the Bill Stewart symbol?" And I say, Yeah, exactly. So that's something that we absolutely need to be able to get past as well. And I think that's partially an age thing too. I think me and you are kind of around the same age.
Yeah.
Married for a few years, things, you start to care a little bit less about what everyone else thinks of you just naturally. So that's part of it as well, is just kind of growing up and getting out of those phases that people find themselves in. The other thing is being able to, like, that's another thing that I like about the jam session that I bring to as well. If there's a cymbal that I really like, I can hear five other drummers play it in different scenarios in that same night. And I can hear, okay, is this something that just sounds good in my practice room to me? Or does this sound good when I'm listening to it, other people play it? If it's a cymbal that I put it on the bandstand, no matter who's playing it, I'm like, yeah, that's awesome. That's my kind of the first step into thinking, okay, maybe I need to explore this cymbal a little bit more. And then there's some cymbals where I'm like, this is the craziest, most awesome cymbal ever. And then some people at the jam session, I have two cymbals set up. That's just how I play. So I always kind of try to pick some things that either work together or are a little bit different, so I can see who's going to gravitate to what. But sometimes there's like the one that's here that's like, this is the main ride, this is the most awesome cymbal ever, and then this one's kind of whatever. And then I see people go, and then they're playing this cymbal all night.
Yeah.
And I'm like, what are you doing, man? Yeah. Like, that's the good one over there.
Yeah. I put the good one in the main position.
Yeah, exactly. But now you're playing on the left side ride all night. And that's another thing to help, I guess, keep the ego in check as well. It's like, what sounds good to me, and what, what I think is going to be perfect in the moment is not always going to be best for what's right in that scenario. Yeah. And then people come up to me afterwards and they're like, man, that cymbal on the left side is so, so awesome. It's like the coolest cymbal ever. And I'm like, okay.
Yeah.
The point that's noted, point taken. I need to look inwards a little bit and see what it is.
Yeah.
It's about building a relationship too, like we were talking about before.
Definitely.
Getting to
yeah.
know them.
I think alongside that, it kind of is what we were sort of talking about earlier, where your tastes change as you become more experienced. Like, my tastes are wildly different than they were when I first started hammering on cymbals.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's like, I've grown. It's like, I think part of it is maybe being willing to change, being willing to grow into having a different set of ears. Like we think when we're young, we'll maybe work really, really hard, practice a lot, and listen to a lot of music when we're really young, and go, okay, well, I've listened to a lot of music. You know, I've practiced 6 hours a day for a year, so I kind of know what I want. And then you can kind of get yourself sort of locked into, like, this is what I like, this is what I want. It's almost like being willing to be open to experiencing different things and different ideas, and being willing to have someone sit on your cymbals and gravitate towards the one that you didn't maybe like as much. And then if you're open, you can go, okay, well, why is that? And then you start thinking about it, and it takes you down a rabbit hole, takes you down a path that leads to, oh, I didn't realize I had this awesome thing over here that I wasn't really taking into account. And then you incorporate that. Then all of a sudden it becomes more, you become expanded. Like, you become deeper, like your ears become deeper. Like I've had a couple of my favorite drummers of all time be in this room playing some of my cymbals, and like total pinch yourself moments. And they never gravitated towards the cymbals I liked, ever. Like, one of the guys was literally just, he grabbed this cymbal that was a total, like, this weird experiment where I had totally, like, done this wild thing I'd never done. I went into a cymbal that was really thin. I had done this crazy patina, and I just did this weird hammering thing I'd never done before. And I literally done it the day before, and I put it in the shop. I was like, that's a throwaway, because I'd hated it before. And so I kind of just set it over there, and I was pulling cymbals out for him. He's testing them. He goes, oh, I like these, I like these. And then he looks over and he goes, what's that one? And I go, oh man, I don't want him to play that one.
You
was
trying,
like,
to stand in the way of it. What?
Yeah, yeah. What are you talking about? But I went over and I grabbed it, and I put it on the stand, and I stepped back, and he played it. He hit it, and then he played it. And my mind was blown. I was like, I hated that symbol this morning when I played it. But now that he's playing it, like his touch, all this stuff. And then he was freaking out about it. And that ended up being like that moment ended up being the launching of one of my series. Cause it was like, okay, I have to just like explore this avenue and see like, where does this lead? And that became the start. And now I'm kind of to a point where I've integrated that sound that I hated before. I've integrated that into my palette, so to speak. And now it's one of the things that I gravitate towards, where I hated it before. Now I love it. And it's just the ability to be open and flexible and kind of be able to take in new information and be able to just be willing to go down a rabbit hole. You might be that way, you know, choose to exist in that state. And in the end, find, well, yeah, I still don't like that. But at least you know now, you know, you really do know because you've explored.
You've given it a chance at least. And you come away with a different perspective of it. It's like listening to a musical artist that you never really wanted to listen to before for whatever reason.
Right.
But then you find one song that you kind of like, and then it leads to more stuff. And then all of a sudden you're like, wow, this person's actually great. I don't know what my problem was.
Yeah.
But it's what you said before. It's being willing. That's the biggest thing. It's being willing to change and admit that you might have not been thinking about something in a way that's proper and not thinking about something right.
Right.
And that's kind of what the journey that we've all been on. Like it's something that that I've heard you talk about with other people, and I've talked about it with Dave and stuff too. It's like, the most important thing for us is knowing when you're done with a symbol, which is so hard to do sometimes. I've had symbols where like it sounds really good and I'm playing it, and then I kind of touch down. I'm like, ooh, this spot's a little bit soft here. So I'm going to go in and try to fix that. And I go into that one spot and there's five other soft spots that created just from those couple of hammer hits. And then all of a sudden I'm chasing all these soft spots. It's an extra 45 minutes of work, and now the symbol is not what you had in mind for it.
Yep.
And then it's not that same kind of quality. And there was one symbol that I made for a local drummer here, a friend of mine, who he came in and he was like, okay, like I'm kind of looking for an Elvin-ish kind of mixed with a Tony-ish sound. And I'm like, okay, all right.
Yeah.
let's see what we can do here. So I just started doing a little bit of research, as we all do, looking into the sounds and the shapes and everything. I was like, you know what? I'm just going to use my ears. I'm not going to try to think of any – I'm not going to try to look at the symbol and say, okay, it needs to – I want the customer to know that that's what I was going for, to look exactly like that, because that can be misleading. Like, I don't want people – I want to try to get people away from shopping with their eyes for symbols, which is something that we've all done. I'm not begrudging anybody. It's something that we've all done.
Yeah.
But it's something that we need to try to get away from too. And so I ended up making it was a very traditional build. Something that I'm going to probably be releasing as not really a series, because kind of everybody has their traditional stuff, but there would be like the traditional SFCC symbols. And then there's the traditional control, which is the same thing, but it has that Bill Stewart band of unlathed stuff on the outside, which I personally love. The way that sounds, it adds complexity, but it just adds, like in the name, it adds control. You can really lay into it when you're riding it without it getting too, it just restricts the vibration at the edge a little bit. So it gives it a little bit more control. So it was a 20 inch traditional control kind of thing. No patina, no nothing, no big hammering, just got it into shape, lathed it down to the not necessarily the weight that I wanted, which is another aspect of it. It was a little bit heavy for me.
Yeah.
But then I was playing it and I was like, you know what? I'm going to let this rest. Let it rest. It's going to sound completely different in 2 days. So I let it rest. And then I sent my buddy a video of it. And he was like, that's the best sounding cymbal I've ever heard. And I posted it on Instagram and it got way more of a reaction from people who were, is what we were talking about before. I'm like, why do you guys like this cymbal so much? It's not even paper thin. Why do you care so much?
right.
But then that was another step in that direction of like, okay, we need to step away from from the preconceived notions that we have and just use your ears.
Yeah.
Play it. If it sounds the way you wanted it to sound, more or less. Give it a little bit of time to develop. And then you can always go back to it after. You can always add more work, but you can't take anything away. So you want to make sure that you're being patient with whatever it is that you're doing.
Totally. Yeah, I try to work a lot of cymbals at the same time so that when I get them to like a version that is close enough to finish, they sit. And they sit for, you know, 3, 4 days, 5 days, a week, 2 weeks. Sometimes they'll sit for weeks on end, and then I'll come pull them back out. It just gives me time to like let them. It really, honestly, I think I the reason is like it needs to rest. But honestly, I feel like I need perspective. So if I step away and then when I come back, I'll have a brand new perspective. Yes, it will have rested a little bit, but I'll come back with a new perspective on it. I'll hear it in a way that I didn't hear it when I just finished making it and hammering it. You know, it's going to be different. Which I really like that. I do want to get in a little bit just to, before we wrap up, like get into your, you alluded that you have some series. I know you just released a series. Tell me a little bit about like the product offerings that you have and what sounds they're meant to aim at.
Cool. Yeah, man. So the, wish I had more of them here, but they're all on Instagram. People can see them. So but I released two series at the same time that are kind of not necessarily opposites in terms of the sound, because they all kind of I kind of had a sound in mind for both of them that's not super different, but they're different enough that it warranted a different series. But one of them is called the Semi Dry series, which was more me just trying to make a super basic build, something that's nice and easy to produce, that has a consistent sound, that would be on the lower side of the price. So if people want to start experimenting with independent cymbal smiths and stuff like that, and try to get into the process and get into our world a little bit, it's kind of an entryway point for that. They're just a basic build, medium high profile, and they're only lathed on the bottom, so it's that semi dry kind of feel. And those ones are, I've had some good response. It started as a set of hi-hats that I made just kind of as, you know, just I wanted to make a semi-lathe, like a half-lathe kind of set of hi-hats. And then a couple more people commissioned those. And I had an initial version of a semi-dry ride that I kind of liked, but it was also one of those cymbals where I took it to the jam session and it didn't work. It disappeared when the horns were being played, and it just didn't have the quality that I wanted to it. So I modified it, released it, sold it as something else. And then from that point on, I was thinking like the way I made the hi-hats is probably the way I should just make the rides, because so they can have that cohesion. It ended up working pretty well. And then the other set is the Maritime series, where it kind of goes the other way. They're more complex. There's heavier hammering. They're thinner with a little bit of a higher profile. They come stock with rivets and they have a thick patina on them, the vinegar and salt that gives you the bluish hues to it. And that was kind of, I called them the Maritime series because it's kind of me thinking of an idea of finding an old set of cymbals out in a shipyard or something. Marching cymbals that, you know, people, the marching drummers that came over on the Mayflower or something would have brought with them and left to sit and do that, do their thing for 100 years. So that, and those ones are, they're not like exorbitantly priced, I don't think, but they're in the higher end of the price, and they, like we were talking about before, I think they demand a little bit more attention in how you play them. They're more complex. There's going to be more sweet spots if you look for them. There's going to be a little bit more tone in there and more of an exploratory kind of feel to it. But those are the two main series. And then we talked about the traditional stuff that I'm planning on releasing out. Like, that's less of a series and just more of a, when people say like, yeah, I don't really know what I'm looking for, but I just want a handmade ride that's going to do you know, a little bit of everything. That's kind of what I would, the road I would go down. And then I have the tribute stuff, which was the first one I did was the Howard Curtis symbol that was based off of the George Colligan records. And that one was, I didn't come up with that idea. That was, I don't know if you know Alpar Edogan. He's drummer in Amsterdam, who he messaged me and he was like, I want to get a cymbal made that's kind of modeled after my teacher, because Howard Curtis, I'm pretty sure he teaches in Vienna, but he goes back and forth from different schools and stuff. So he's over in Europe. So a lot of people have access to him over there. And he had this old K that was a 20 or a 22 inch that was a little bit on the heavier side. But it had some of those qualities that a lot of them have that we wanted. It was a little bit flatter up top, but it had that hook towards the edge, a flatter, wider bell, you know, all that good stuff. So we started working on that. And I ended up, it was like, it's weird to admit, but it was actually a mistake, because he gave me a weight range that he wanted. And I, not realizing at the time how much weight actually comes off of a 22 inch ride when you do a single pass, because the bigger the cymbal, the more weight you're taking off in one pass. So I got it like a lot thinner than what it was supposed to be, but it still sounded good. So I sent it to him and I was like, this isn't really what our target weight was. But then I started thinking too, it's like, if you want this ride to sound like it does on the record right in front of you, usually a thinner weight is one way to achieve that with the same shape.
Yeah.
So I sent it to him and he loved it. He's been posting about it and telling his friends and everything. So that, and then every time I've made one of those, it sold almost immediately. So I was like, okay, I think I should probably try to keep these guys stocked. Like it's a thing. Yeah. And then the next one after that, the one that's going to be releasing on January 9th is the Kenny Clark series ride, which is his, it's Kenny Clark's birthday. I've had it finished for a while, but I wanted to kind of make a little something about it and do a video about it.
Nice.
But yeah, other than that, that's kind of what I've been going for. And Joe Perry was a huge help in trying to get that Kenny Clark sound, because he's a guy who likes heavier cymbals generally. Mm. So I was picking his brain a little bit, and he was really into it, sending me records and says, yeah, listen to it here. Check this out. Sending me pictures. And Paul Francis sent me a couple pictures too.
Nice.
Sent me a video saying like, here, you can get a really nice clean shot of the ride cymbal in this video at this timestamp. So
nice.
I can never really take too much of the credit when making these kind of things. Like it's always, I always have so much help, even when I don't really even ask for it. That's what I love about our community. You know, it's very tight knit.
It is.
That's pretty much it. That's it for me.
I love it. So people can find your stuff on, what's your website?
It's SkretasFamilySymbols.com. SKRETAS. Same thing for Instagram. Instagram is where I do most of my stuff. I've been wanting to make a Facebook page, lately as well. I just haven't really gotten around to it yet. But the Instagram is the main thing. Skretus Family Symbols on Instagram. And then my website's in the bio. You can check prices and you can get my email address and my phone number and stuff is on there. So that's always the easiest way to reach me.
Yeah. Love it, man. Thank you so much for doing this. I think I say this almost every time, but this was one of my favorite episodes.
It's true.
I do. I've said it like consistently. Things. It feels like. I don't know. We're all similar. We talked about that earlier. We're all kind of have a similar journey. We tend to be like similarly minded people, and there's always so much more to talk about than just symbols, because it does touch on every aspect of life. It touches on art and creativity and craft, and sometimes like we get into like the business side of it, which is always interesting. And but yeah, I really appreciate you being on.
Yeah, I appreciate you you let me do this, man. It's totally. It's a huge honor.
Oh yeah. The honor is mine. Guys, check out Manny Skretus's stuff, SkretusFamilySymbols.com, and on Instagram. And we'll see you guys next time. I'm Timothy Roberts. This has been the Reverie Podcast.